award in Canada. And when I received awards for that book from people who were ostensibly interested in capitalism and economics, I always wondered whether they read the book. Because you get to about chapter 8 and there's an extended argument saying that that we have to stop it. Economic growth is currently defined on the planet, that it's destroying the planet. And it's another quite elaborate argument. It draws on a number of different sources, including Marxism. And so I am surprised that it was listed as one of the best books of the year by the Financial Times. And I think they actually did read it. I'm going to flatter myself that they actually did read it, and that some of these very contentious issues are moving back into the core of public discourse, including the evolution, I believe, this century towards a steady state economy, which will either be voluntary or involuntary. If it's involuntary, it can be very messy. So I'd like to make it voluntary. That's not the issue I was planning to talk about so much today, though. I was going to raise some questions and try to provoke some conversation among us about this issue of scientific reticence in an age of really quite extraordinary threats to the well-being of our species. And it's an issue that has been raised in particular by James Hansen of the Goddard Institute at NASA, one of the world's leading climate scientists, and quite provocatively, in particular, an article that appeared in The New Scientist last summer. But first, the first part of the lecture I want to, or my comments, I want to make the case that we are really facing a serious situation, perhaps ultimately an unprecedented threat to the species, and that perhaps this defines a circumstance where the responsibilities of scientists are somewhat different from the responsibilities that they might have understood that they have had in the past. I come to this particular issue with a somewhat non-disinterested perspective. When I was an undergraduate, I became deeply involved in the international Pugwash movement. And some of you may be familiar with the Pugwash movement. It's an international movement of scientists that was founded in the 1950s by Bertrand Russell and about 10 Nobel laureates, including Albert Einstein. It was the last document he signed before he died. He died 2 days later. And it called on scientists from around the world to meet in conference. This declaration called on scientists from around the world to meet in conference to discuss the development of the super, which is the thermonuclear bomb, which Oppenheimer, as you know, had tried to prevent from being developed, but was developed, thanks in large part to the enormous creativity of Edward Teller. And there was a sense among scientists that they had done something that it was potentially an enormous threat to the well-being of humankind. And the first meeting of scientists from East and West was held in Pugwash, Nova Scotia, under the auspices of Cyrus Eaton, a Canadian-born American industrialist who'd made his fortune in steel and coal, but had been born in Pugwash, Nova Scotia, and that, ergo the name, the Pugwash movement. And it was an extraordinary event because some of the top scientists from the Manhattan Project and a number of top scientists from the Soviet weapons projects came together and talked about what they had done, what the implications were. The movement continued, and it's still very vigorous. It won the Nobel Prize for Peace about half a dozen years ago or so. And I became involved as an undergraduate and set up the student Pugwash movement in Canada, which over a period of time became an international movement. It no longer exists in Canada. The focus of that enterprise was an extension of the underlying rationale behind the senior Pugwash movement, which was that scientists have some kind of larger social responsibility for their work, and that they need to consider what the implications of their work are, and take an active role in the formation of public policy, and maybe even be advocates, on occasion aggressive advocates for one perspective or another. Now, this is a contentious, I think quite a contentious argument to make, The Pugwash movement itself had a great deal of influence. It was instrumental in the development of the partial, in the background negotiations that led to the Partial Test Ban Treaty, which moved nuclear explosions underground. It was instrumental in the negotiations that led to the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which the United States has recently abrogated. It was instrumental, as it turned out, in the initial negotiations for the negotiations that led eventually to negotiations in the Vietnam War. The scope of the Pugwash movement expanded to consider all aspects of scientists' role in social affairs and their ethical responsibilities in society. So I have a strong opinion about this. I think scientists do have a role and that there should be an end to reticence. And I think it's now we're in a time where especially climate scientists, and some of you may be involved in some of the modeling that relates to climate science, should be speaking out. And I want to make the case for the first few minutes that this isn't a situation that Al Gore has characterized as a planetary emergency, and I think he's basically right. These are the 2007 surface temperature anomaly data from Goddard. We're looking at temperature anomalies, and I'm going to just assume this is a really high-level audience, probably one of the highest-level audiences I ever addressed, so I'm not going to bother defining a lot of stuff. What we're looking at here is the temperature anomalies in Celsius against a baseline of average temperatures from 1951 to 1980. And then we're looking at warming in the north in 2007 in the neighborhood of 1, 2, 3 degrees Celsius, perhaps over 3 degrees in some parts of the Arctic. The substantial warming in the north is driven by mostly the ice albedo feedback effect, which I'll come to in a moment. These are Goddard data, just came out about 2 weeks ago, showing the warmth, the mean surface temperature for the planet as of each year. Each dot represents the mean surface temperature for the planet going back to 1880. Big uncertainty bars back here, these green bars. Smaller up here, data are better. The red line is a 5-year smoothed average. You probably heard this discussion about, has global warming stopped? Well, what people are doing is they're taking the second war, the, well, actually the third warmest year here, which is 1998, and they're sort of they're drawing a straight line here. The only audience I know would laugh at that. I mean, it's roughly like, you know, drawing a straight line here, a straight line here, straight line there, you know. So it turns out that 2007 was the second warmest year. 2005 was the warmest year. 1998 was the third warmest year. The smooth average is still rising. The Earth's climate is a chaotic system, and it's affected substantially by the flip that goes on in the South Pacific called the ENSO, which is the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which is a sort of sloshing of water back and forth in the South Pacific that affects climate weather patterns around the whole planet. This particularly warm year in 1998 was a result of what they call, you know, sort of a 1-in-100-year El Nino event. We happen to be in an El Niña now, which is the opposite phenomenon, and that is one reason we're seeing a lot of snow this year. Temperatures probably in 2008, at least for the winter period, will not be as high. We'll probably see a dip here. We also happen to be at a minimum of solar radiation, and solar radiation is probably going to start increasing. It goes through kind of an 11-year cycle. It can start increasing soon, and so there's a fair consensus that we're going to see sharply escalating temperatures after about 2010.
Temperature
of the air. It's tropospheric temperature. It's basically land. Just, you know, those little temperature gauges that are in boxes, and it's all normalized for heat island effects and things like that. They try to separate all that out. There's a lot of work goes into generating these data. There are 3 or 4 different groups in the world that do it, and they have a rough consensus about what the warmest years have been.
Can I ask you why?
You know what?
I think if I take questions, I mean, what's the normal procedure here? But because I start taking questions on this, I'm sure we're never going to finish. But what's the normal procedure?
But just very good questions like mine.
You know, I did my PhD at MIT. I know about guys like this. Yeah, go ahead.
Questions.
Yeah,
and discussion.
And I have to tell you, though, I am not a climate scientist. So you may quickly, you know, I read this stuff, I study it for 20 years, but, you know, you may push me beyond the boundaries of what I know. Let's see.
Curiosity, if zero as an enemy in there, or is just a scale, a randomly chosen scale?
The zero, what we're looking at is, I should know this, that the zero represents so this is the pre-industrial period, so we're looking at probably temperatures, and this, the average temperatures in this period from, you know, 1930 to 1980, something like that, is representing the sort of the zero point. It's actually, what is it? 55 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that, average temperature of the planet. I can find that information out. I've got it in my bag. These are scenarios produced by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. What they do, we don't know what the future is going to be like, so we have to develop scenarios for the patterns of economic development we're going to see in the future,
which will lead to certain levels of release of greenhouse gases, in particular carbon dioxide. So what they do is they take a set of variables that define, that can be used to define the future, population size, levels of technology, particular kinds of technology that are used, for instance, what kinds of car engines are going to be used, trade relations between developed and developing regions of the world. And they plug all of this stuff, and they take certain values for each of these variables, and each set of values represents a particular configuration for the future, and they plug that configuration into a model that allows them to generate carbon emissions, and then they plug the carbon emissions projected out to say 2100 into a general circulation model, a climate model that gives us an estimate of the change in temperature on the planet. And they usually, for IPCC, they take all the major climate models in the world. There are about a dozen of them, and they average. And the climate models may have some common errors, but there's enough independence among them that you hope that the errors in them probably cancel each other out. What they're finding is this is generally A1B scenarios, considered sort of modified business as usual. This is the world that we'll get if, according to these models, if we continue with more or less the trajectory we're on right now. And you see the scale across the bottom from 0 to 7.5, 8 degrees Celsius. So let's expand these 20, I dropped out 2020 to 2029. 2020 to 2029 indicates warming in the neighborhood of 1 degrees. 1.5, maybe 2 degrees Celsius across Canada. Just to give you a sense of the magnitudes that we're talking about, the total warming of the planet since the coldest period of the last ice age is about 5 degrees Celsius, since the coldest period 15,000 years ago. So we're seeing very substantial warmings in very short periods of time relative to what the planet has seen before. This is what we're looking at within possibly the lifespan of my 2-year-old, certainly the lifespan of his children, warming across Canada of around 4 degrees, in the north of Canada around 5 degrees, and in the Arctic around 6 degrees. What we're seeing in the Arctic is a function of what is called, in part, the ice albedo feedback effect. I know you've all heard about it. You melt the ice, more solar radiation is absorbed by open water. Just one second, about 80% more solar radiation. Because the water is warmer, it impedes refreezing of the ice in the subsequent winter. The ice is thinner, it melts more easily the next summer, and you get a vicious cycle. There are probably half a dozen major positive feedbacks like that operating in the north. The big issue for climate scientists over the last few years is trying to determine what the relative balance between negative, equilibrating feedbacks and positive, destabilizing feedbacks is. The evidence is now quite clear that positive feedbacks dominate the climate system. And there are two kinds of positive feedbacks. I'm going fast here, but again, I've seen that, you know, you are used to dealing with high baud rates. Two kinds of positive feedbacks. There are kinds that relate principally to energy flows in the system, like the ice albedo feedback. albedo is surface reflectivity. The second kind of carbon cycle feedbacks, where warming actually changes the concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere, perhaps by increasing concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere. That can happen because warming causes, for instance, the permafrost to melt. And it's, as it rots, it releases large quantities of methane, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas, which causes more warming. It could happen because certain sinks in the world, carbon sinks, stop operating so efficiently. About 50% of the carbon dioxide we emit is absorbed by the oceans and land. Those carbon sinks are extremely important. And if they stop being as efficient, then you get higher concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. There is evidence that the carbon absorption of the Southern Ocean around Antarctica, which is one of the most important carbon sinks in the world, is starting to decrease, that carbon sink is becoming saturated. Warming around Antarctica, it's suggested, is increasing the speed of winds. Higher wind speed is drawing deep, high carbon-saturated water up from below, which is reducing absorption at the surface of the ocean. I'll come back to that in just a moment. There's a question. Yeah.
Any of those models reproduce what was seen in the last century?
Yes. In fact, I have a wonderful slide, which I could go to if I had a few minutes. But basically, this is what it says. It's a marvelous slide. The backcasting is very good. What they do is they have the actual empirical evidence of the temperature trend. And then they do two separate kinds of inputs in this particular slide. They first of all, they input natural factors that would affect surface temperature on the planet. Volcanic eruptions that eject a lot of sulfur particles into the atmosphere that change the albedo of the atmosphere. Changes in solar radiation, et cetera. And the models do, using those inputs, do a fairly good job of reproducing the changes in the planet's temperature, average temperature, during the middle part of the 20th century. Then they input anthropogenic forcing factors, nitrous oxides, carbon dioxide, CFCs, et cetera. And then the models not only mimic the middle part of last century very well, which appears to have been largely affected by natural factors, but the last 40 years is almost perfect. So the consensus that you see reflected in IPCC statements is that the warming of the last 40 years cannot be explained without reference to anthropogenic factors. And it's based on that kind of backcasting success. And it gives us, you know, some moderate confidence in what we're looking at in the future. The big unknowns here include things like the relative balance between positive and negative feedbacks, the potential for nonlinearities in the system, that we will push the system and it will flip to a different climate equilibrium. Any other questions? These are good questions. Short, not contentious. We'll deal with that, I'm sure. OK, so what we're looking at here are data of minimum sea ice extent in the Arctic. Going back to 1978, coming up to 2007, regressed, as you can see, from an average extent of around 7 to 8 million square kilometers down 2007 to around 4.17 million square kilometers. This was a jaw-dropping event for people last August and September, those climate scientists around the world. When these data were coming out, we were all on the National Snow and Ice Data Center website every day, and you could just hear, you know, to sort of mix the metaphors, the intake of breath among climate scientists around the world. They couldn't believe this. It may well be, we'll have to see what happens over the next few years. I would expect that there's going to be some recovery. But it may well be that we're seeing the first large-scale anthropogenically forced nonlinearity of a macro characteristic of the climate, the cryosphere, which is the system of ice on the surface of the planet. So we may be in the middle of a flip. This is a slide produced by Lawrence Livermore. There are the actual data, 2007. These are model results derived in part from IPCC scenarios using different models. Run 1 through run 7. These are model results of sea ice extent. There's September minimum sea ice extents in millions of square kilometers. And you can see that they didn't expect us to get to where we were last year for another 20 to 30 years.
Increase predicts a drop of to about 10% of what it was.
up here. Yeah, the IPCC was suggesting that we would see a complete disappearance of summer sea ice in the Arctic by towards the end of the century, 2060, it looks like there, maybe 2080. That reflects scientific data and studies that were in vogue, in a sense, in 2004-2005, because the guillotine came down on the introduction of science into the IPCC process in mid-2005. The reports came out in 2007. During that two-year period, there was an enormous amount of science. By 2006, middle of 2006, the climate scientists I was talking to were saying we're looking at full sea ice loss in the Arctic in the summer by 2040. Based on the evidence that we saw last year, a lot of them are saying 2015 to 2013, complete losses of Arctic sea ice. Now, at this point, we're in kind of a world of unknown unknowns, to quote that famous phrase that Donald Rumsfeld used, which actually one of the smartest things he ever said, but won a lot of competition, I guess. But he was absolutely excoriated for it. You know, he said in the Iraqi theater we have known unknowns and known unknowns and unknown unknowns, and everybody thought he was talking absolute gibberish. But in a complex system, you don't know what all the connections are. And you really are fundamentally ignorant of your ignorance. You don't even know what questions to ask. And clearly, we're in a situation like that in some respects with the climate right now. We are in a world where changes are happening whose consequences we really can't anticipate. The Arctic, above the Arctic Circle, some of you can probably do this calculation in your head and tell me whether I'm right or wrong, but I believe that area above the Arctic Circle represents about 9% of the surface area of the Earth's sphere above the equator. You change that from high reflectivity to low reflectivity, and you're going to change the energy balance of a large portion of the planet. That's going to do things like affect the circulation of jet streams, which affects the patterns of storms around the planet. It's a big deal. Food production starts to become a key variable there because are rains going to fall where they have fallen in the past in places where we have conventionally grown large quantities of our food? We can talk more about food later. Another thing that people have found is that the models representing ice sheet melting are, at least as they were represented in the IPCC report and in the modeling that was used to understand sea level rise, the potential for sea level rise in the IPCC reports, are probably inadequate, in fact, radically inadequate. The IPCC input models use basically static ice sheet models, which suggested that in Greenland or the Antarctic, you'd get warming of the atmosphere melting on the surface of the ice sheet, and the water would sort of run off the surface of the ice sheet down into the ocean. It actually turns out that you need dynamic ice sheet models. Many of these ice sheets and glaciers have cracks in them. In fact, as they warm up, they develop cracks. The water that pools on the surface runs down the cracks. It helps lubricate the movement of these ice sheets into the sea. It also, and this is something you don't hear so much about, takes enormous amounts of heat energy down to the bottom of the ice sheet. So even if you cool the surface of the ice sheets, you still got all that heat energy at the bottom needing to do its work. At the same time, warmer oceans at the leading edges, I don't know if I've got slides here. No, I don't. Warmer oceans at the leading edges of these ice sheets where they come into the sea, for instance, in the fjords in Greenland, and this is particularly important in Greenland, those warmer oceans are nibbling away from underneath the tongue of ice that goes out into the sea. That in the fjords in the past, you've had these essentially like corks in a bottle, large bodies of ice that stopped, that have plugged up the flow of ice and kept it from moving into the sea rapidly. Those corks are eroding. And the combination of water, here's Greenland, flowing down to the bottom of ice sheets through holes that are called moulins, M-O-U-L-I-N-S, that sometimes can be 10 to 15 meters across, hundreds of millions of tons of water moving to the bottom of these ice sheets, along with the disintegration of these plugs of ice at the heads of the ice sheets in the fjords where they move into the ocean.
means that we're probably looking at much higher rates of movement of ice out of Greenland, out of West Antarctica, into the ocean, which changes our estimates of sea level rise very substantially. And this is what the issue that James Hansen is particularly concerned about. When you talk to climate scientists, it's sea level rise that they're really exercised about. So what are we looking at? The IPCC figures say 20 to 60 centimeters of sea level rise this century, and everybody went, ah, okay, that's okay, we can deal with that. You know, we add a few bricks on top of our sea walls, and have somewhat more powerful pumps to drain the basements of buildings that are along the coastline and stuff like that. But basically, we can deal with 20 to 60 centimeters. It sounds manageable. Based on this more recent estimate about dynamic ice sheet changes, the consensus among climate scientists now is a meter. That's what we're seeing emerge. A lot of them are talking about 2 meters this century. And James Hansen, in his New Scientist article, says that there is an entirely plausible argument that once things go, because this is a nonlinear process of melting, that you could see 5 meters this century. So what are we talking about? Greenland is not going to all melt right away. But if it were, you would get 5 meters of sea level rise. West Antarctica gives you 7 meters of sea level rise. Antarctica as a whole gives you another 50. So you've got 70 meters of sea level rise in all of those bodies of ice, those three bodies of ice. The last interglacial, 125,000 years ago, the period between glaciations, saw temperatures that were probably below what we're going to have at the end of this century. And at that point, Greenland was largely melted, and sea levels were 4 to 6 meters above where they are right now. There's evidence, paleoclimatological evidence, that suggests that once these processes start, you can get a meter every 20 years. This is something that can't be reversed once it starts, which is why a lot of people are arguing for very, very aggressive cuts of carbon dioxide right now. And even among climate scientists, although they haven't been too vocal about it yet, geoengineering of the planet's climate now, rather than waiting till the process of melting in these areas starts. You talk about even 2 meters, and we're talking about a major threat to some of the most important cities in the world. New York, London, Amsterdam, of course, big cities like Mumbai, Dhaka, and Bangladesh, large portions of Bangladesh. These are not things that become sort of marginal adaptation problems. They become catastrophic changes to the world economy. And this is the kind of thing that climate scientists are really quite exercised about. Just to extend that point, in the last year and a half, talking to climate scientists regularly and working with them, maybe 2 years, I've seen a substantial shift in the sentiment of climate scientists, from one where they sort of regard climate change as something that's a matter of real concern, to now thinking it's a matter of grave urgency. The sort of seminal event for me in helping me understand the shift in mentality, psychology of climate scientists, was a workshop that I attended at Harvard last November with some of the top climate scientists in the United States. Small group, 30 people, and the topic was geoengineering. And these are people who wouldn't have touched the issue of geoengineering with a 10-meter pole before about a year ago. But now they're at a state where they're saying, we may not be able to get ahead of this problem. We need to start thinking about intentional modifications of the planet's climate if things start to go haywire really quickly. So the third part of this argument I'm going to be making today, I've talked about positive feedbacks. I've talked about dynamic ice sheet melting. And the third part relates to changes in fuel mix on the planet. And suggests that we're in a time when we really should be cutting carbon emissions, we seem to be going in exactly the opposite direction. What we've got here is a chart of global oil discovery and production going back to 1900 up to about 2005. This is global oil discovery. Conventional oil. Conventional oil represents about 40% of the world's commercial energy, about 95 to 98% of the world's transportation energy. It's the stuff that the planet's economy literally runs on. It's the reason for the major increase in the planet's population over the last century. Over the last century, we quadrupled the planet's population. We quadrupled the yield from your average hectare agricultural land in the world. We increased energy inputs into that average hectare 80-fold. That's 80. The expansion of the human population is a function of enormous inputs of high-quality, cheap energy. That era is largely coming to an end. We see that the peak of global oil discovery occurred around 1964 at around 60 billion barrels of oil, and has declined pretty well steadily since then. With this reversal, that is a period of time when the North Slope fields in Alaska and the North Sea fields in Europe were discovered. We see production increasing pretty steadily at around 2 to 3% a year, in significant part because of industrialization and rapid increases in energy intensity of China and India. And then, of course, you notice this gap at this end where on an annual basis we are producing and consuming somewhere between 5 and 10 times as much oil as we're discovering. Last 2 years ago, we discovered 4 billion barrels of oil. Last year, 2 years, it was 3 billion. Last year, it was 4 billion barrels of oil. We're discovering somewhere around 30 billion barrels of oil on an annual, we're consuming around 30 billion barrels of oil on an annual basis. That gap cannot be sustained indefinitely. We're only able to do it now because we're consuming resources we discovered a long time ago in places like Saudi Arabia. The great oil fields of Saudi Arabia were discovered in the 40s and 50s, and they're old. The issue, first of all, is that this will probably peak. This line will peak and start to decline. Not clear exactly when, although there's some evidence it's happening right now. Just one moment. What happens at that point, following a decline in global oil, conventional oil production, depends largely on the rate of decline. If you look at existing oil fields around the world that have reached peak and started to decline, the rates vary between about 3% and 12% a year. If it's 3% a year, people say 3% and they don't realize just what that does if you go out a few years. But we can probably manage using by increasing production of non-conventional oil like tar sands, by liquefying coal, by using renewables, ramping up nuclear. If we're looking at 8% or more, there's no way that we're going to be able to adapt globally, and energy prices will go up very sharply. Here's an interesting data point. One of the fallback energy sources in a world of increasingly expensive conventional oil, by the way, I want to say what I mean by increasingly expensive conventional oil. It's energetically more expensive. You have to use more energy to go and get it. You have to drill deeper in more hostile environments to find smaller pools of lower quality oil. It takes you more energy to get it. And one of the consequences one of the fallbacks in a world of more expensive conventional oil is using deep sea oil, which of course is also energetically very expensive. These wells you're seeing drilled now in the Gulf of Mexico and off the coasts of Brazil, you know, they go through 3 miles of water and then they go through 4 miles of salt dome or something like that to get down to the oil and natural gas. Each well costs $1 billion. This is big time, very expensive. The decline rates on those fields when they peak are 12% a year. And that's something that's not been widely reported. The average decline rate around the world that we're seeing is 4.5% for land-based oil fields. So we're going through an energy transition. It's going to be driven by the increasing energetic cost of conventional oil. And there's a consequence to that for climate. Yeah.
I was wondering about the tar sands, I mean, how they would be incorporated in that, because it's not very clear when they were discovered.
Well, this is conventional oil, right?
Oh, I see.
So okay. Tar sands are considered unconventional. I'll come to that in a moment. In fact, I'll come to it right now. So EROI is the energy return on investment. That's the amount of energy you get back for every unit of energy you invest to get the energy. The energy return on investment in the United States and Texas, when the United States peaked in its oil discovery in the 1930s, was 100-1. They got back 100 barrels of oil of energy for every barrel of oil of energy they invested to drill down into the ground and pump oil out. In the United States now, the energy return on investment for conventional oil is 17-1. Around the world, it averages at around 20-1. The energy return on investment for the tar sands is roughly equivalent to oil shale out here, which is around 4-1, maybe 3-1. The energy return on investment for corn ethanol is 1-1 or less. So you put about as much energy in as you get out. This is nothing but a subsidy for the farming sector, right? Sugar ethanol is around 8-1 from Brazil, so it's better. Although There are some very important papers that came out of Science just this past week, looking at the total consequences, the open system consequences of clearing land and substituting ethanol biofuels for food crops, which causes secondary effects for land clearing. And at that point, the carbon consequences start to actually become, even for sugar ethanol, become much less favorable.
Yes, that's true. And a lot of this stuff, this water, corn ethanol in the United States is watered using irrigation that draws water from fossil aquifers like the Ogallala Aquifer, which you can't do indefinitely. So comparative energy returns on investment, oil, shale, corn ethanol, this is like the tar sands here, coal liquefaction, terrible. But look at coal, 80-1. So the punchline is that the increasing energetic cost, especially the conventional oil, is driving us to fuel switch, to more carbon-intensive fuels.
Curiously, what's the roadmap for uranium?
Well, there's a big dispute about nuclear power. I'm trying to nail some of those data down, but perhaps 10-1. It's not terrific. It's not terrible. Historically, just keeping an eye on the time here, historically, the human species over the last 200 years has gone through a series of energy transitions that have produced a progressive decarbonization of the energy of the fuel system. So from moving from wood to from wood to coal, to oil, to natural gas, each one of those transitions we've emitted less carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for each unit of energy produced. A lot of energy specialists thought that this decarbonization trend was an essential characteristic of the progress of human energy systems.
This is a modeling that was done in 2000. Here's the empirical data from 1900 to 2000 showing that decarbonization, and then some model results, which overall seem to suggest that the decarbonization trend would continue. If we look closely at the last 20 years, though, we see something interesting. 1980 to 2003, in this case, there appears to be a decrease in carbon output per unit of GDP. So that appears to be decarbonization. But then you realize that almost all of that decrease has been a product of increasing energy efficiency overall. We're using less energy per dollar of GDP. And if you actually look at the amount of carbon released per unit energy, it stayed about flat. So there hasn't actually been much decarbonization over the last 20 years. If you look at the last 10 years or so, we're seeing what I would call a recarbonization of the global fuel system. And one of the best ways to illustrate this is by looking at the annual increment of carbon, incremental increase of carbon in the atmosphere. In this case, over Antarctica, where the atmosphere is very well mixed, we have each a ppm reading for CO2 for each year, and then the change from year to year. The average, of course, you know, you can decide where you're going to divide, what line you're going to put here, whether it's here or here or here, and it changes how the figures turn out. But the average for up to 2001, 1.64, the average up to 2006, from 2002 to 2006, at 2.1. There's no doubt that we've seen a jump. This figure is now heading towards 2.5, 3 parts per million per year. The difference is about 0.5 parts per million. Where is it coming from? It's coming from increasing size of the world economy, especially increasing energy intensity of China and India, and their heavy use of coal and increasing use of coal. It's coming from saturation of carbon sinks, such as the Southern Ocean that I was talking about before. And it's also coming, about somewhere around a fifth of it is coming from increasing carbon intensity of the global fuel system. Climate scientists, when they use figures about the quantity of carbon emitted into the Earth's atmosphere on an annual basis, for many years were saying about 7 billion tons, 7 gigatons. You know, and then it was increasing incrementally each year, 7.2, 7.3, 7.5. But we were all sort of had fixed in our mind that it was somewhere around 7 billion tons a year. But what we see here, again, are these IPCC scenarios. In this case, we're looking at carbon emission scenarios. So that's the first stage of the scenario process. From 1990 to 2010, that's the worst case scenario, the A1, F1. And here are the actual data laid over top. from two different studies. And this was what I'm going to show you next was another jaw dropper for climate scientists. This came out about 10 weeks ago. So 2006 comes in at almost half a billion tons, 8.4 gigatons, half a billion tons above the worst case IPCC emission scenario. This is why people are talking about geoengineering now. Just a little bit on coal, quickly. I'm saying that one of the things that's driving this is increasing carbon intensity of global fuel system. Coal provides around 25% of the world's primary energy. It provides 40% of the world's electricity. It grew at around 5% per year between 2000 and 2005. In China, China doubled its coal production from 1.3 to 2.6 billion tons between 2001 and 2006, from 1 ton per person to 2 tons per person. 90% is consumed in the country of origin. We don't ship it around that much. Coal produces nearly 40% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. The only way we're going to deal with coal is through carbon capture and storage. I call this a sine qua non technology. It's an absolute necessity. We've got to get this worked out. And we need to get it worked out fast, and we need to get it implemented. If the world is going back to coal in a world of increasingly expensive conventional oil, then we've got to pump the carbon from that coal underground in enormous quantities. Canada can be a world leader on this. We're dithering. We're making a hash of it, as usual. Investments in other places of the world are still minimal compared to what needs to be done. We need Manhattan Project scale investments in this technology. And this is a quotation from the Future of Coal report that came out last year from MIT, which makes, I think, the point very clearly. Here's an indication of the scale that we're looking at. Sequestering 1 billion tons of carbon per year requires injection of about 50 million barrels per day of supercritical CO2 from 601,000 megawatt coal plants. And that gets you about an eighth of what we need to do. The capital requirements, human capital and financial capital requirements of the kind of energy transition we're going to see in the next 50 years are probably beyond anything that humankind has ever experienced. This is going to be bigger. Economists call this a general purpose technology transition. Something like the electrification of society, the introduction of railroads, the introduction of personal computers, the internal combustion engine. We're going to go through a GPT transition of a magnitude that's probably going to be greater than any one of those, and perhaps all of them combined. It's going to change every single aspect of our societies, not necessarily make us poor or less well off. In fact, during every GPT transition in the past, there's been an explosion of growth and innovation because there's an enormous amount of investment that's needed. But it's going to be very different. And the reason that we're not making progress is because there are very powerful groups that are threatened by these changes and are trying to block and want to hold on to the status quo and are trying to block change.
Cold and very dense. So you chill it. I don't know what you chill it to, minus 50, something like that.
Cold and dense. So the challenge, very soon, humankind must cap and then ramp down global carbon emissions. We have little room to warm. Estimated safe warming is around 2 degrees Celsius. The warming to date is around 0.8 degrees Celsius. The warming in the pipeline, even if we stop all emissions right now, everything is around 0.6 degrees Celsius. And that gives us about 0.6 degrees Celsius to warm. And that means we have very little room to emit. The estimated carbon concentration that will produce around 2 degrees Celsius warming. And beyond 2 degrees Celsius warming, the consensus among climate scientists is that we're then into a world that's 2 degrees warmer than pre-industrial temperatures. We're then into a world where these positive feedbacks will have a high likelihood of developing enormous force. If the biosphere starts to basically emit large quantities of carbon dioxide on its own, then it doesn't really matter what we do at that point. So we want to keep it below 2 degrees warming. The current concentration is 380 parts per million. The room to emit is 70 parts per million. The incremental increases, as you've seen, is around 2 parts per million and rising towards 3. And so that means we've got 30 years before we get to 450. That doesn't mean we've got 30 years to act. It means in 30 years, we need to be heading fast towards 80 to 90% reduction in carbon emissions globally. we can disaggregate the challenge we face into these three components. We're going to have to lump it for some of the changes. There are going to be very significant climate changes on the planet. There's no way out of it now. So we're going to have to lump it. This is the lumping it component, the realized impact. This is the adaptation component, which means we do things that allow us to continue with a decent quality of life despite the fact the climate is changing. And then there's a significant mitigation component, which basically means reducing our carbon output. And we're not making any progress on reducing carbon output, but we have to get ahead of this. Just to say what we need to do, the most important institutional change to reduce our carbon output is getting a global market for carbon emissions in particular. We need a global market for carbon that produces a price on carbon emissions of around $30 or more per ton. At that point, it changes the whole cost-benefit calculus for just about everything in our societies. You'll find entrepreneurs everywhere on the planet looking for every kilogram of carbon they can keep out of the atmosphere. The first thing the president has to do, he or she, in the new administration in the United States, is go to China and talk to the president of China. Those two countries make up 50% of the world's emissions. If we don't have them on board, nothing can be done. If both of them are acting in concert, then it changes the negotiation problem substantially for the rest of the world. 8 countries or regions, including Europe, in the world, let's say China, Japan, United States, Europe, Canada, and a few others, India, all around the table, collectively represent about 80% of world carbon emissions. It makes it a much more tractable negotiation problem. Okay, so let's get to this issue of reticence, because I know we're at the end of time and we want to talk a little bit. Hansen raised the issue of scientific involvement in getting popular attention and in generating popular mobilization around these issues a number of years ago, and he's becoming much more vocal about it now. He calls the tendency for scientists to err on the side of extreme caution in their prognostications and their analysis. He calls this the John Mercer effect. You can probably read through it here. Because of what happened to a climate scientist by the name of John Mercer, who suggested that we might be in real trouble. And it was quickly learned as a norm within the climate science community that you just don't do this if you want to be taken seriously. The problem with that kind of reticence is lags in the system. But that might be fine if it turned out that the climate scientists were wrong and they're reticent, and 20 years from now the climate's going haywire and we can do something then to fix it. The problem is, by the time the climate is going haywire, it's going to be too late to do anything about it. This is sort of the underlying logic of what's called the precautionary principle. We need to be extremely prudent in dealing with systems that have long time lags and are potentially nonlinear in their behavior. He says, I can vouch for that from my own experience. After I published a paper in 1981 that described the likely effects of fossil fuel use, the US Department of Energy reversed the decision to fund my group's research, specifically criticizing aspects of that paper. I believe there is pressure on scientists to be conservative. Caveats are essential to science. They are born in skepticism, and skepticism is at the heart of the scientific method and discovery. However, in a case such as ice sheet instability and sea level rise, excessive caution also pose dangers. Scientific reticence can hinder communication with the public about the dangers of global warming. We may rue reticence if it means no action is taken until it is too late to prevent future disasters. As I mentioned, I have a 2-year-old son at home. I imagine lots of you have got parents or you're thinking about starting their families. I look at Ben and I see 80 years in the future, and I don't like what I see. And I know that if we leave these problems to his generation to solve, it's going to be too late. But I also know that there's one source of hope in that, one very important source of hope. Across all the divisions in our world, divisions of race, of ethnicity, of language, of class, caste, the one thing that every human being who's a parent agrees on this planet is they want the best possible future for their kids. And they also tend to agree on what that means. It means a world in which their children could flourish and have the greatest potential for developing as human beings. Doesn't mean a world that's abundantly rich necessarily in material things. It means a world in which they're secure and they can flourish. Now, that's the starting point, I think, for having a global conversation, a real conversation, an emergency concert conversation about these challenges. We're not having it yet. It seems to me that it's really important that scientists actually, in some cases, get off their ducks and get out there and do what they can to start it. Okay? Thanks. I should say it's really, really nice to be able to talk to people where I don't have to explain a lot of stuff, you know, just go.
What is very important, and you don't communicate, is how difficult of an issue this is to mitigate. So let me just ask you some questions. I imagine you know the answers. Okay, so supposing that the United States, Europe, and China agreed that from now on every car that's produced is a hybrid, agreed that we have a crash program to capture carbon from all the coal plants in the world, and grow as much sugar, ethanol, and the things I understand coming down of waste products. So in other words, there's a list of things that we know a lot about.
Yeah, most of the technology is already there.
Right. So the two questions are, how much in some units, like proportion of world domestic products, how expensive actually would it be to do everything that we know how to do now, and what proportion of the problem would that solve?
That's a really good question. Now, I could, the place to start with that kind of question is the Stern Report, Nicholas Stern Report that came out at the end of the end of 2006. The British economist, former World Bank economist, charged by Tony Blair with providing an estimate of the economic costs of climate change to the world, suggested in a nutshell that the economic costs of climate change as you go out into the future are vastly larger than the costs of fixing it now, which I seem to remember amounted to something like about 1% of GDP going out through 2050.
If we did all those things?
If we did all those things, relatively small. But I'd have to look, because there are issues about, so does this mean you're knocking 1% off, say, a 3% growth rate? I think that's probably what the best interpretation, because the standard estimate is that business as usual is that the world grows in real terms around 2 to 3% a year.
But in other words, the message is entirely doable.
It's entirely doable. Now, I don't think Stern was looking at the kind of target that now is in the ether in climate science communities, which is an 80 to 90% reduction by 2050. Because as these data, what's happening, unfortunately, and climate scientists don't want, they have kids, right? They don't want to believe what they're seeing. Their motivated bias is actually in the opposite direction from one that a lot of climate skeptics think. They actually want the data to come in positively. But what we're seeing is, in most cases, the data are coming in at the pessimistic end of the range of possibilities that climate scientists have proposed. And which is why they're increasingly suggesting we have to go essentially to a zero carbon world at some point over the next, say, 150 years, and we need to be a long way there. The last increments are going to be very hard to get, but we can get probably 20% fast, 40% not too badly, but the next 40% is going to be really tough. The last 20% is going to be a big deal. But carbon sticks around in the atmosphere, people now realize, for 1,000 years. It's not eliminated anywhere near as quickly as people thought, especially as these carbon sinks start to saturate. So I don't think Stern was assuming something like stabilization. But let's stabilize carbon output, assuming fairly optimistic things about absorption rates in sinks. Let's stabilize carbon output so that we keep ourselves, I think, probably at 500 to 520. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, people were saying, let's cap it at doubles pre-industrial CO2, which is 560. And now people are saying it's going to be too high. So a much more aggressive enterprise to reduce carbon, not just stabilize at, say, 560 or 520, but actually not go above 450 and then reduce carbon output by 80% or more, is going to cost a bigger chunk of global GDP than Stern estimated. What that's going to be, I don't think people have done the estimates yet.
So you outlined the problem very sharply for us. What actions would you like us to take, or what actions should we take to combat this problem?
Well, it depends very much on what you as individuals do, right?
Right.
Because I think everybody has something different they can contribute. And you have to think about your own circumstances, your own aptitudes, your resources. This is what I call a ground war. It's going to be a problem that's addressed one conversation, one conference, one meeting like this, one letter to the editor, one run for political office at a time. Some of these things will make a big difference. Some of them will only make a difference within a small group of people. It might be a conversation around the dinner table at which somebody's mind is changed a little bit about something. But the key thing here is that social systems are also complex nonlinear systems. We went through some amazing change in the late 1980s and early 1990s where a set of social institutions, the East Bloc, the Soviet Union, and its allied states, basically vanished peacefully in a period of just a few years. Nobody anticipated that. I spent the whole 1980s in a graduate department at MIT that had a big cohort of Soviet studies specialists. And nobody thought that it would just vanish like that. Not only vanish, but vanish peacefully. That was one of just a remarkable social nonlinearity. What often happens with social systems is you get all of this stuff happening, almost unseen, and then you get a sudden reorganization of the system. So think about what you can do as individuals. I do know that lots of people are deciding, this is it. There's only one thing that really matters at this point. And these are wealthy people, they're changing the direction of their careers, they're stopping what they're doing and focusing on some new task. It's one reason I'm coming to Waterloo, to be frank.
I was just going to just say something more specific about how we keep these powerful vested interests of capital out of the academic.
Yeah. Well, that
reminds me of the problem with smoking causing cancer.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. The parallel is absolutely exact. This is a longer story for another lecture, but I think fundamentally dealing with these special interests is a problem of popular mobilization, and that is a large problem of the revitalization of democracy. You see, I think your average person is pretty smart. I start from the assumption that your average person is actually pretty smart. My last two books have been bestsellers in Canada. They sold tens of thousands of copies. The last one had 100 pages of endnotes. I get dozens of people coming up to me saying, I'm so glad you put all that stuff in there because now I can go out and learn about it myself. There's an enormous appetite for knowledge out there. I mean, as very smart, particularly smart people yourselves, you can learn about these issues and talk to people. Something that can be done individually.
There were two questions in the back.
Yeah. Just a really quick comment back to the Stern thing. I'm maybe misremembering this, but I'm reasonably certain that he estimated the cost of not doing anything about it is about 30%.
I didn't mention that. He said it would be on the scale of one of the Great Wars or the Depression.
About 30%, as opposed to 4%.
Now, one of the sources of contention in that report is that he used essentially a zero discount rate, which basically says the costs of the future are as large in to present actors as they would be in the future. The fact, because traditionally economists assume that we discount the present future costs, normally at a percentage rate going out each year that's roughly equivalent to the prevailing interest rate in the economy. There are so many problems with conventional economic thinking on discounting that I don't even know where to start. But a lot of conventional economists attack Stern very aggressively because of his assumption about zero discounting. It's an important, not only technical, but philosophical debate. What is our responsibility to future generations?
Yeah.
Yeah, concerning this issue of scientific reticence, do you have any sense, or better yet, information about how many scientists are against the notion that climate change is a problem versus 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
That's a really good question, and this is all impressionistic, okay? I started working on this issue at MIT in the late 1980s, and I would say that there was the split in the cognoscenti, the knowledgeable scientific community, was roughly like this. I would say 30 to 40% saying this is a problem, 20% saying that this is not a problem, we don't need to worry, and let's say in another 40% in the middle group prepared to be persuaded by the discussion on each side. I can remember there was a debate in 1988 between Stephen Schneider and Dick Lindzen. Dick Lindzen, a very much still climate skeptic, and Stephen Schneider, one of the world's leading climate scientists, that filled the Kresge auditorium at MIT, and there were 1,000 people there or something like that, because people wanted to know, okay, what's going on here? And there were lots of, in a sense, fences. As times evolve, what we found is that the middle has disappeared, and that a group of people who are skeptics have become progressively smaller. And I think we're literally talking about handfuls of people. The people who, if you look closely at the list of people who sign these petitions that say we don't have a problem, there are very, very few trained climate scientists on them. Now, I have to be careful here because I'm not a trained climate scientist, right? But if you do sort of bios, you find economists and statisticians and geographers, you know, and others. Almost all trained climate scientists, with maybe just a handful of exceptions in the world, think that this is a very serious issue now. That there's absolutely no question that human beings are driving climate change. The climate scientists who don't tend to be second-tier climate scientists. They're in second-tier institutions, they publish in second- or third-tier journals, and they're frequently funded by the energy industry. I hate to be so ad hominem about this, but it's true. So one of the problems, and this has been well documented in the study, is that the media insists on any issue of presenting two sides. So what has happened is, as we've seen this shift in scientific sentiment, the consensus developed, you're actually finding that there's a bias towards climate skepticism in the media because you hear about this tiny minority over and over again. They get overrepresented, and the real distribution of the opinion is not represented. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And just as a follow-up, what about the non-expert group of academics that are more influential? I'm thinking particularly economists, maybe sociologists, etc.
The economists in particular. The economists in particular are a key group here. And I think actually what's interesting, I'm planning to write about this soon. We're actually looking at a problem that's developed in the world that essentially has a number of features that are extremely difficult for conventional economics to deal with. For instance, the climate change puts front and center the issue of our responsibility to future generations. So it puts front and center the questionable logic of a discount rate. It also, the economists assume, this is one of their fundamental assumptions, that wealth is infinitely substitutable for all resources and services the natural world can provide. So they assume that we have alternatives in responding to climate change. We can either spend money now to deal with it, or we can make ourselves wealthier and wealthier, and then when climate change becomes a problem, we can fix it at that point. The assumption of infinite substitutability of wealth for resources and services, natural services, is profoundly flawed. And there are a bunch of other things. Economists can't deal with non-equilibrium thermodynamics. Economists can't deal with non-linear systems because they're grounded in a neoclassical, Newtonian equilibrium mindset and ontology. So we're actually, economics, modern economics, is in a sense the undergirding ideology of our capitalist democratic systems. And it's profoundly destabilized by anomalous data coming in from an external world. Modern neoclassical economics says that we can grow indefinitely. The world is saying, sorry, we're starting to run up against limits. So I think that the debate with economists
is probably one of the most important ones out there. These guys, they have to develop a new perspective.
And so the results of them are basically not on side or not on side the way we need to be?
They are talking what Thomas Kuhn would have called incommensurable language. It's like we're talking right past each other. They are operating, the assumption of equilibrium, for instance, is so profoundly accepted and assumed that it's not even seen in modern economics. Like economies naturally gravitate towards equilibrium between supply and demand. The market's clear. Everything we know about the world is that equilibrium systems are actually extremely rare. Right?
Rifkin is a counterexample.
What's that?
Rifkin, Germany.
Yes, yes. And there are lots of great complex systems economists and ecological economists out there who are starting to think differently. But this is this again, one thing I'm hoping to do at Waterloo is really dig deep into this issue of the kinds of revisions that need to be made in economic thinking.
I'd like to, sorry.
Can I take one more?
Well, you can, but let me propose that we pause, we thank
okay.
Professor Homer Dixon again, and then we continue until 3:30. Some
sure.
People might have commitments.
Yep, and I do have to leave at 3:30.
So let's thank 3:30.
You think of population as kind of a deep system driver. Poehler, like John Poehler, came up with a very valuable model about 30 years ago called the IPAP equation, I equals P times A times T. And so impact on the environment equals population times the activity per capita that population times the technology that population is using. Now, it's metaphorical more than anything else. But what it helps emphasize is that population is a very powerful driver of impact on our natural systems. But its impact is fundamentally determined by the nature, by what those people are doing and what kind of technologies they're using. Every extra Canadian, like my son Ben, consumes on average 50 times the resource of every extra Indian. One of the things that's causing real trouble for the world right now is that Chinese, and to a lesser extent Indians, are moving very fast from a 1 in 50 impact to, say, a 1 in 20, and maybe a 1 in 1 impact compared to us on the environment as individuals. So population, China's 1.3 billion people, that wasn't a huge deal until they started doubling their coal production over 5 years, right? Yeah.
So let me ask a question about what we as people who are trained in theoretical physics can do. And let me pose it as a series of negatives, okay? I mean, we could say to ourselves we could do climate modeling, but it sounds like the science is done.
In each one of these, I'll just say something quickly. I just came from a meeting over at the faculty, which will be called the Faculty of Environment, that's next year, where they're planning on setting up a really terrific enterprise, which is an interdisciplinary center on climate change.
Is that called CG?
IceCube. No. CG is, there are a lot of interesting things happening here. CG is essentially a policy-oriented think tank that focuses on governance, right, global governance. This is going to be an interdisciplinary climate center, probably the best in the country. There are a lot of mathematicians who are involved in this project on the Waterloo campus, and my guess is that they would be thrilled that people here were involved too. Modeling is, there's still all kinds of issues on modeling that have to be sorted.
Okay, so the second, good. So
no negative on that.
And we can talk about it. So the second thing, I mean, you mentioned, you know, economics and the assumptions of equilibrium being wrong and so forth. So, I mean, we have been hearing that from people like Stu Kaufman, Prabhat, et cetera.
So you had Stu Kaufman here?
Yes.
Oh,
and some of us work with him.
And the other thing I want to do when I get here is I want to connect everybody who's doing complex systems theory together.
Right, okay, okay, so I'm a little bit part of that world.
Yeah.
And one heard many years ago, and one continues to hear, there needs to be a better economic theory, there needs to be an economic theory based on driven far from equilibrium systems
yeah.
rather than equilibrium
yeah.
systems.
Okay. Yeah.
But since the issue is urgent, okay,
we don't want to wait for the development of this new calculus.
Well, the question is, you know, I mean, so I was recently in a discussion of some of this, you know, ex-Santa Fe people, ex-BioSpeed people, you know, sort of what can we do about these things? And the issue is, you know, in a certain way, the Santa Fe Institute failed. The revolution that they wanted to make did not happen.
Yeah.
Why, you know, why do we think we could do better now? Could, is that worth putting time and energy
into? I think it's a really, really good question. The issue is, did Santa Fe fail because there was no there substantively, or there were just insurmountable obstacles to progress in theoretical and conceptual development of complexity theory? Or did it fail because of the structure and the personalities involved?
Now, or because the time wasn't right.
Or the time wasn't right, exactly.
Yeah. So I agree, and I don't know the answer.
All I can say is that I'm teaching at U of T last year. I taught the first complex systems, social systems course, I think perhaps in Canada, but certainly the first at the University of Toronto. So it was complex, theories of complex social systems, war and peace. And I attracted the best undergraduates on campus. And at least one of them has decided to make this the focus of his career. The thing about complex systems theorists is that they don't actually, and this is one reason they become very atomized, they're not, the complex systems theory and complex systems tools are just methodological. They tend to focus on the whole range of things, from market behavior, in this case, Mato wants to focus on food systems. And I think that's one reason that there's not a really coherent community in a lot of ways. I don't know the answer to your question. But I do know that our conventional ontologies and our conventional methodologies that come out of political science are just completely inadequate for dealing with the challenges we're facing. Now, I think that this is kind of a pre-Newtonian era. But Newton came along and he developed a calculus. He developed a calculus because he wanted to solve certain kinds of problems. Now, we have things like agent-based modeling and some sexy things that we do on computers, but it doesn't have the same coherence-producing effect that the calculus did in allowing for, in a sense, a paradigm, an ontology of the world to develop around a methodology. And we're at that stage. I have to believe that this is possible because I think it gets to this. We need a new intellectual edifice for different ways of looking at the world, which is one reason I come to UW. I'm really hoping to start creating complex systems group. We're going to the provost on Friday to propose a complex systems institute on campus, so that all of these people who think that there may still be some there can start talking to each other.
You mentioned a workshop on geoengineering.
Yes.
But it would be nice to know of some examples.
Okay, so what do you do? Let's go back. The simplest thing you can do is just saturate or increase the concentration of sulfate aerosols in the stratosphere. This kind of stuff that Mount Pinatubo in 1991 threw up into the atmosphere. The sulfate crystals are highly reflective, so you make the atmosphere more reflective. They're basically, just step back a bit, there are two approaches to geoengineering. One is changing the amount of solar radiation that reaches the surface of the planet, and the other is actually reducing the amount of carbon cycle. All things being equal, if there was kind of frictionless choice, you'd actually want to do the carbon one because it's carbon that's causing trouble. But getting carbon out of the atmosphere is actually really, really hard. It's kind of an entropy problem. You know, it's widely distributed and enormous quantities of it. It takes a lot of energy to get it out of the atmosphere. So the simplest thing to do is reduce the incoming solar radiation, and the simplest way to do that is create basically a haze of sulfur particles, sulfur dioxide crystals in the stratosphere that reflects solar radiation. Then you start getting more complicated. Now, you could do that, I should say. You could do the sulfate aerosol approach for about $30 billion a year, which in terms of the scale of the global economy, is essentially free. It's within the capacity of a very large number of countries in the world to do it, which is an interesting problem, right? If you start to get individual countries deciding to geoengineer because they're being affected severely by climate change.
Getting more complicated. Now, the person who could talk about this, if you want to invite David Keith sometime from the University of Calgary to speak here, I strongly recommend it. You can you can custom design particles that are like little mirrors. They may be very, very small, not nanotechnology, but still micron level technology. They're multi-metallic or they have layers of different material, and so they orient themselves in the Earth's magnetic field in certain ways. And you can actually design them so that they lock themselves to a particular level of the stratosphere and migrate to a particular part of the world, in particular over the poles. You might want to do it over the poles. Now the problem with that is, once you put those things up there, they're probably going to stay for a long period of time. The sulfate precipitates out in 3 years. So if it actually turns out that there are known unknowns in the system and you made a really big mistake, the status quo ante of some form is going to return in 3 years. But with these other technologies, custom design technologies, you might be stuck with it for a long period of time. You can put reflective technology out in space at a place called Lagrange 1. Does anybody know that? Mm-hmm. Lagrange 1? Lagrange point, which is basically a static point in space between Earth and space, just Earth and the Sun. And you need to block about 2% of solar radiation. You could do that with clouds of particles again. But again, once they're up there, you've got the entropy problem. You're not going to be getting them back probably there for a long period of time. So what are some of the consequences? Well, if you're simply blocking incoming solar radiation and everybody's still having a carbon party on Earth, it means carbon dioxide concentrations will increase. And the biggest problem there that we know about is that the oceans are acidifying. And the consensus is that by around 2080, 2100, we'll be reaching levels of acidity. pH in the oceans will drop to such an extent that all organisms with calcium carbonate in their bodies will no longer be able to reproduce. So that means coral, certain kinds of phytoplankton, mollusks, big ecosystem. Andrew Weaver even suggests that you're talking about, to a large extent, sterilization of the oceans. They would become planets. The most sensible thing to do with geoengineering is to use it, and I think this is what we're going to do, by the way. I think there'll be demands for this within 20 years, which is use it to get us past the hump. That we have about a 150-year period here where we're going to be transiting through a radically different social structure. Don't know what it's going to look like, that will use different energy sources, probably renewables, maybe fusion. We might disperse our cities, we might concentrate our cities, lots of decisions to be made in that way. We'll probably have a lower population on the planet because we're going through a hump up to 9 billion and then we'll start declining through natural processes. We have 150 years where we have to get through this transition, and we're going to peak in carbon emissions and then start to decline. And for that period of time in the middle, we're going to have to geoengineer. And the key thing is we're not committing endless generations into the future to do it. If, on the other hand, if we have what economists call a moral hazard problem, which means as soon as we start talking about geoengineering, as soon as we start doing it, everybody says, well, let's just go, guys, burn all the coal, and we pump up CO2 levels in the atmosphere to 2 times, 3 times, or 4 times, perhaps if you burned all the coal, 8 times the amount of pre-industrial carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, then essentially we're committing generations for potentially hundreds, if not thousands of years in the future to maintaining a geoengineering system. I said to my colleagues, as the only political scientist in the room, I said, social systems tend not to be so coherent over long periods of time. To maintain a system where you're dumping quantities of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere for long periods of time, you would have to, you need a competent scientific elite, you need capital aggregation, you need to be able to, you need government infrastructure to actually organize it. This public good you're generating. The society on the planet that's lasted the longest with one coherent, stable set of recognizable institutions is the United States. And it's less than 300 years old. And less than 100 years after it was founded, it had an enormous civil war. And I asked these guys, do you think if the United States had been charged with maintaining
the planet's climate, that they would have continued firing those artillery shells into the stratosphere or locked in balloons full of sulfate up into the stratosphere through the entire Civil War. And this is very scary. We're into a world that most people would have defined as complete science fiction just a few years ago. And there was a palpable sense of despair among the scientists that were there. Let's take one more.
Yeah, Michael?
Are there any known negative consequences of pumping all these sulfate aerosols into the atmosphere?
Actually, well, yes, there are. I mean, the first is that and everybody there at the meeting was recognized that we don't understand the world, the global climate system well enough to be able to know what the possible downsides are. They've done a lot of modeling. It looks like you get if you increase the albedo of the planet's atmosphere in its entirety, not just at the poles, you get drying in the equatorial regions, where large numbers of people live, which would actually create problems for constructing a global field to geoengineer the planet, because large numbers of people probably wouldn't want it done, because it would undermine agricultural production in those regions. And a substantial drop, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% decrease in precipitation. But a lot of people assume if you're using sulfates that it's going to sort of acidify everything, but it actually is. It's not so much a question of the amount, it's a question of where you put it in the atmosphere. It's actually a smaller amount of sulfur in the atmosphere than we emit on an annual basis to standard industrial processes. But we're just getting higher into the atmosphere. The biggest issue is really unknown unknowns. And the fact that you're not stopping the buildup of carbon dioxide, which means you continue to acidify the oceans. Okay.
Thank you, Professor.